With U.S. foreign policy at the center of this week's news cycle, questions of patriotism are becoming sharply partisan.
The only ones that are mourning the loss of Soleimani are our Democrat leadership.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for January 9th, we'll zero in on how members of the media are viewing the relationship between patriotism and journalism. Also on the show, a look at the challenges faced by the few people of color coaching in the NFL.
Once they get these positions, it's difficult for them to keep it. Like, there's been countless times where African-American coaches have had 1 year to either make it or not, and then they're fired.
And with West Side Story back on Broadway, we'll explore the complicated legacy of the musical's depictions of Puerto Ricans.
There's going to be always a group of naysayers who want to say this text is problematic from its inception. At the same time, then too, if it weren't controversial, frankly, I probably wouldn't be interested in it. We wouldn't be talking about it today.
All right, everyone, let's get to it. Over the past week, as attention has been on U.S.-Iran relations, a familiar refrain has played out from some on the right.
The only ones that are mourning the loss of Soleimani are our Democrat leadership.
Nancy Pelosi does it again, and her Democrats fall right in line. One, they're in love with terrorists. We see that. They mourn Soleimani more than they mourn our Gold Star families, who are the ones who suffered under Soleimani.
That's former U.N. Ambassador and Governor Nikki Haley and GOP House member Doug Collins speaking this week. But the accusation has been made about journalists as well.
I bemoan the fact, especially even since the Iraq War, that it feels like patriotism is largely dead amongst our journalism corps. Well, where's the home team for a lot of these people? Taking a moment to cheer and appreciate that when America kills one of our enemies on the battlefield, that's a good thing. It just doesn't feel like that exists much anymore.
Right.
That's Pete Hegseth of Fox News this past Saturday. And Hegseth isn't the first commentator or pundit to question journalists' loyalty or patriotism, especially in the midst of a national crisis, in the aftermath of the September 11th terrorist attacks, and in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003, similar conversations unfolded.
Do you believe that Ms. Amanpour, as Ms. Professor Byers does, has been a fair correspondent in this conflict?
Well, quite frankly, no, I don't.
I think that the coverage of the war by NBC seems bizarrely focused only on the IEDs, when stories that are so fascinating and interesting, those stories are out there for anyone to get.
It is somewhat institutional, and there is partisanship on the part of the media. Do you see the same thing?
Scheer is perhaps the most radical journalist writing in a major newspaper today, and his moral indignation and blatant anti-Americanism is revolting.
Joining me now to discuss the relationship between journalism and patriotism is Paul Fahrey, staff writer and media reporter for The Washington Post. Paul, glad to have you with us.
Thanks very much, Tanzina.
We're also joined by Aaron Haynes, a political reporter covering the 2020 election. Aaron, thanks for being with us as always.
Happy 2020. Great to be back with you.
So we're starting off the year, Paul, with this debate that we're back into about journalism and patriotism. You wrote about this for The Washington Post. In the eyes of Trump supporters and commentators, as we heard at the top of Fox News in particular, what is patriotism?
Well, in their definition, patriotism is loyalty to the people in power, the government that has been elected. That's not the way journalists would define patriotism. In doing our jobs, we are patriotic by questioning the people in power. And that's the fundamental break and the fundamental difference and why they're critical of us.
Aaron, you tweeted about this yesterday, and you said, quote, "We as journalists, I should say, are in the Constitution. This is among the most American of jobs." So to that point, Aaron, why are journalism and patriotism so often framed by commentators as incompatible?
Thank you for the question, Tanzina. And let's just take a moment to back up and be very clear on what freedom of the press is and is not. And let's start by just reading what the First Amendment says for people who maybe don't remember that, which is that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now, I mean, for us, like Paul said, the home team doesn't change. It's truth and democracy. And as journalists, we are really at our most patriotic when we are speaking truth to power, shining a light on injustice and wrongdoing and holding the powerful accountable, even when that work happens in wartime, and even when those in government are the subject of that journalism. And, you know, I mean, at first it was frustrating for me, which is why I took to Twitter. But then, you know, I remember that attacks on the press are as old as our democracy, which is likely why the framers protected press freedom in the first place by codifying it in our founding documents. So on the one hand, I do understand that I'm having some version of the same argument that Americans who came before me who were members of the press had with their fellow citizens. But on the other, it is kind of frustrating that more than two centuries after the First Amendment was added to the Constitution, that more people just really don't understand the need for a free press or how that works.
And to that point, Paul, I mean, this is an argument that's resurfaced multiple times. We've seen it. We just heard some clips from the top of the show here about post 9/11. There were the weeks and months before the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Give us a sense of some other moments in U.S. history where we've seen this debate surface.
Well, one that I think a lot of people would remember because it was a great movie made about it is the Pentagon Papers. Back in 1971, the Washington Post and the New York Times published this secret account of the Vietnam War. It was immediately criticized by the Nixon administration, which went to court to stop the publication of the Pentagon Papers. And we in the press, the Times and the Post, were deemed unpatriotic for exposing what the government itself was secretly saying about the Vietnam War. And then you had the government telling us we couldn't publish that information. So this has a very long history. I imagine it predates America itself and goes back to any kind of wartime and any kind of correspondent who covered that war. The people in power hate it when they are questioned, especially during an emergency. And so it's almost, I don't know, reflexive or natural that people who are conducting warfare don't want their actions questioned.
Aaron, I'm wondering also, I mean, you just read us the actual constitutional text here that protects freedom of the press. How much of this is rooted in what Americans don't understand about what journalists are supposed to be doing, literally what our job is?
I think quite a bit. And I know, you know, that lack of understanding may be due to any number of factors. But what I do think is especially true in this particular climate and moment in our country is really that partisan distrust of the media is fueling questions like the one that Paul raises in his article. And that's an important point, particularly in this age of disinformation, where there are those who would corrupt the public trust for their own ends. I mean, the value of free and fair press is really more important and more American than ever. And the threat to a free and fair press is very real today, both in this country and around the world. And while the First Amendment does not guarantee my job, as you know, some people, I guess, kind of interpreted from what I tweeted, that is not what I'm suggesting, but it does guarantee my right to do my job. And that's a right that I take seriously and attempt to carry out with integrity every single day. And I know hundreds of journalists that are doing the same thing in newsrooms around the world. And they are an essential part of our democracy, because I know that the work that we do, that pursuit of truth and effort to right wrongs, you know, which is the mission of so many of us that got into this business, is in furtherance of this democracy and of perfecting our union.
And Aaron, to that point, I mean, when it comes to comments, as we've heard, particularly from the administration and I think increasingly in more conservative media circles, that comments like fake news, comments like we are the enemy of the people. Do you think those are, in addition to the fact that our patriotism, quote unquote, is being challenged, do those actually undermine the news media further?
I would say absolutely. You know, I think that we have seen in recent polling that reflected in people's feelings toward the media. Certainly, those poll results are you can see them playing out along partisan lines. And so that is a message that is resonating, you know, with a lot of our fellow citizens. But, you know, sometimes journalist and always genius, one of my favorite people, James Baldwin, said, "I love America more than any other country in the world, and exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually." And I would posit that many journalists feel the same way, regardless of their color, creed, or political affiliation.
Paul, let's talk a little bit about another emerging line of thought that's coming out here, because some conservatives are claiming that reporters are tougher on our own government compared to adversarial governments or foreign governments. Is there any truth to that claim?
Well, it only looks that way because we live in a democracy in which access by reporters to people in power is, in effect, guaranteed. In Iran, in North Korea, in Russia, in other countries, reporters don't have the same rights, and reporters are often murdered by the regime. So to compare the way we treat our own government, in which the comment is essentially free, as opposed to covering other countries where you can't get access, is an absurd disparity. And we are tougher on our own government because we can write more about our government. We can't get access to interviews. We can't get access to important people in power in those countries to question them. And that's why it just seems like it's an unlevel playing field. But in fact, if we had the same rights in those countries, we would report just as toughly as we do in America.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned earlier the Pentagon Papers, because when you watch the film All the President's Men, there is a sense that, you know, at least initially, that these two men, Woodward and Bernstein, were held up as patriots to a certain extent. Have there been moments, Paul, in history where journalists have been framed as, dare I say, patriotic?
Well, you know, we forget about Watergate, about how attacked and vilified Woodward and Bernstein were, and the Washington Post was during the time at which they were reporting those stories. The Nixon administration press secretary Ron Ziegler was getting on television and saying many of the things that are being said today. The Washington Post is trash, it's garbage, its reporting is not true. In hindsight, you know, with the great perspective of history, this looks like a great journalistic monument to the First Amendment and to the country. But at the time, it was very controversial. And this is typically the thing, typically the case, that we tend to view it in real time as something subversive, when in fact, in hindsight, it looks like a contribution to America.
Aaron, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Aaron.
I was going to say, Paul is exactly right on that point. And really, you know, when I think about, you know, journalists who I also consider patriots, I think about the black journalists who frankly, were speaking truth to power, even at a time, you know, when, you know, the framers certainly didn't envision people like me practicing journalism. And yet, had it not been for truth tellers like Ida B. Wells, who wrote to expose the lynching of her fellow citizens, many of them service members by other fellow citizens, we wouldn't have that record. Or the fearless members of the black press, like Simeon Booker, who also bore witness to the atrocities of Jim Crow, which was not a war in the sense that many of us think of, but was absolutely a war on black people in this country. History remembers them well now, but certainly at the time, they were not seen as patriotic for calling out those injustices.
And to that point, Paul, I mean, how do you see this playing out in the near future? I mean, this is the U.S.-Iran relations going to remain in the spotlight for a while. Should we expect more of these questions about patriotism, loyalty, and journalism?
Yes, of course we should, because the president has made criticizing the press and undermining the press a feature of his presidency. We don't need a war for him to call us fake news or for him to call us enemy of the people. He's been doing that for several years. So as things heat up and as the country gets more and more nervous about the conduct of our foreign policy, you can expect this to ramp up even further.
Paul Fahre is a staff writer and media reporter for The Washington Post, and Aaron Haynes is a political reporter covering the 2020 election. Aaron and Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last month, previews began on Broadway for the revival of one of the most famous musicals in history. That's right, it's West Side Story. The show is making a comeback on Broadway, and later this year, a new movie adaptation will be released, directed by Steven Spielberg. The story is a modern take on Romeo and Juliet, written more than 60 years ago by Leonard Bernstein, Stephen Sondheim, and Arthur Lawrence. The first live production hit the stage in 1957, and in 1961, the film version was released.
Maria!
Quiet.
Come down.
No.
Maria.
Please. My mother and father will wake up.
Just for a minute.
A minute is not enough.
For an hour, then.
I cannot.
Then forever.
The musical was one of the first times Puerto Ricans were represented on stage and on the big screen. while also placing tense race relations in the U.S. front and center. But the work is also fraught with stereotypes. Decades later, West Side Story remains one of the most visible representations of the Puerto Rican community. And with the Broadway revival and upcoming film, we wanted to explore why this piece, for better or worse, remains the defining work in American culture depicting the Puerto Rican diaspora. Joining me from Puerto Rico is Ernesto Acevedo Munoz, professor and chair of cinema studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and author of West Side Story as Cinema. Ernesto, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
And we're also joined by Francis Negron Muntaner, Puerto Rican filmmaker, writer, and scholar, and professor at Columbia University's Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. Francis, always great to have you on the show.
Always great to be here.
Ernesto, give us the historical context in which West Side Story was originally written. What was going on in Puerto Rico at the time, and what was its relationship with the United States?
Well, there was the perception of increased juvenile delinquency and gang activity in U.S. urban certain centers, particularly New York and Los Angeles. And it was really just as an attempt to remake and rethink and reimagine, as we say now, the old story of Romeo and Juliet, that the context became accidentally the perceived race in juvenile delinquency after the waves of so-called Puerto Rican migration to the mainland, starting in the 1920s and 30s, but which peaked in the mid-1950s. And I say so-called migration because Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens since 1917, and technically we're not immigrants to the mainland. We just move there if we can and if we have to.
And Francis, what was the experience for Puerto Ricans in the U.S. during that time period of the quote-unquote Great Migration? My grandparents were a part of that in the post-World War II shift. But tell us from your perspective.
Well, I'd like to start by saying that although Puerto Ricans are not immigrants in the sense that they're coming from a quote-unquote foreign country, given common citizenship and freedom of movement in that sense, I think you could say that Puerto Ricans are unlike other immigrants in the sense that they're colonial migrants. They're coming from a U.S. territory in which citizenship doesn't mean exactly the same thing than for people that live stateside. Some of the experiences that Puerto Ricans had correlate with the fact that they were perceived as foreigners. And that translated in various ways. And they also were put into this racial hierarchy in the lower side of the hierarchy, you know, lower end of the hierarchy.
The song that I think a lot of people think of when they think about West Side Story, the film in particular, is called America.
Smokey in America.
Francis, your thoughts on the iconic song, if you will, of West Side Story?
In the film context, the scene is constructed in a gender binary way. The men articulate a critical perspective and the women articulate what some people would call an assimilationist perspective. So on the one hand, this gendering is significant, and we would ask ourselves, why is it that it's gendered in that particular way? So does it mean that women are perceived to be more assimilable into American culture and society because they're less threatening in some way? The complexity of this scene in the film and in the stage is that it does present certain contours of debates about precisely those questions of what is the relationship of Puerto Rican migrants to the U.S., whether the spectrum of possibility is, do you attempt to assimilate? Is that desirable or not? Do you develop a more oppositional or affirmation of an ethnic identity? And if you look at Puerto Rican experience broadly conceived, I think you'll see that people have developed different strategies and perspectives about that question. And that might be one of the reasons that number resonates, both for people who reject the terms of which is being contested and argued about, but also people that in some ways identify with aspects of that. So in a way, it sums up the at least three ways that I think Puerto Ricans and other viewers might relate to West Side Story. One is overt rejection of the stereotypical narrative. There's a position of a kind of disappointment of an expectation that Puerto Ricans would be indeed incorporated. And then there is the position that I think to some extent I've been located in, which is that we wrestle with this very complex text that in a way has nothing to do with Puerto Ricans, you know. But in another way, it interpolates and is responsible for producing the first major in popular culture cohesive picture of what a Puerto Rican is like, and to bring these questions about what is the relationship between us and them, and who is the us, who is the them, who's included, who's excluded, and why.
Ernesto, what about you? I mean, you've literally written the book about West Side Story, and now there are these two new versions emerging. Do you think it's even worth creating these this innovative take on West Side Story, or should we be looking at new stories about Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans, particularly in light of what has happened on the island over the past, not just 2 years since Hurricane Maria, but really over the past decade, from the economic crisis on to today?
Well, I have read a few reviews of the new Broadway production, which I understand is still in previews, that it hasn't officially opened. And I'm, as everybody else, I am aware of the Steven Spielberg remake. And all I can say, having not seen those products, is that West Side Story allows for conversation. It raises questions. And there's going to be always a group of naysayers who want to say this text is problematic from its inception, from its origin. It perpetuates and perpetrates stereotypes about Latinidad, about New Yorkans, about dancing, about brown face, and all those things are legitimate questions. At the same time, then too, if it weren't controversial, frankly, I probably wouldn't be interested in it. If we wouldn't be talking about it today. And the fact that it can be reinvented, it can be reimagined, sometimes successfully, sometimes less so, is one of the things that makes it relevant. And there has been more attention to the Puerto Rican situation after the 2008 financial crisis. So it is good that this spotlight is on. I just wish that it was just the beginning of the conversation about the Puerto Rican situation, about the colonial situation. We have now seen after 120 years or so that all that the colonial relationship of Puerto Rico to the United States has brought is misery. And that is a relevant question. Maybe we should have a Puerto Rico-based version of West Side Story and see how that goes.
Ernesto Acevedo Muñoz is a professor and the chair of cinema studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and author of West Side Story as Cinema. And Francis Negron Muntaner is a Puerto Rican filmmaker, writer, and scholar, and professor at Columbia University's Center for the Study of Ethnicity and Race. Ernesto, Francis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tensina.
Always great.
Carnegie Hall is one of the most famous concert venues in the world.
The first time I walked on the stage, I felt like my feet were moving, but they were not touching the floor.
Join us for If This Hall Could Talk, a new podcast that explores the history of this iconic landmark through the unique items in its archives. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and together we'll explore how the past shaped the culture we live in today. Listen to If This Hall Could Talk wherever you get podcasts.
To be here.
Hey everyone, it's Tanzina Vega with you on The Takeaway. And we're in the midst of the NFL playoffs. But for the teams that didn't make it out of the regular season, it's hiring season for new head coaches. But out of 32 teams in the NFL, only 4 head coaches are non-white. That's in a league where around 70% of the players are black. In 2003, to increase diversity among head coaches in the league, the NFL adopted the Rooney Rule, which requires teams to interview minorities for head coaching and senior positions. So far, the increase in coaches of color has been less than 1%. Rob Parker of Fox News and ESPN's Stephen A. Smith both sharply criticized the rule this week.
Get rid of the Rooney Rule because it's garbage. It's balderdash. It's poppycock. It ain't real.
Now, the National Football League or somebody else, we got to change this Rooney Rule. It's bogus, clearly, because it's being bypassed. The original intent what it was intended to produce is being circumvented.
Joining me now is Martenzi Johnson, a sports writer for ESPN's The Undefeated. Martenzi, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me today.
So the Rooney Rule was put in place to do what? I'm assuming the intent was to increase the number of head coaches of color, or was it just to increase the number of people who were being interviewed as head coaches of color?
So the original intent when it was implemented in 2003 was to at least get a foot in the door for African-American and people of color coaches. I think by proxy, you know, by interviewing more black coaches, you would get more black coaches in those positions. But what we've seen is it has actually worked. Before the rule went into place, it was about 2.3 people of color coaches per season. Now we're up to about 3.76. So it has worked as far as increasing the number of coaches of color, but we're still a long way from, I think, what Johnny Cochran was trying to get accomplished when he released a study in 2002 showing that there was a lack of diversity in the head coaching ranks.
But that's a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage, Martenzi. I mean, given the overall, the demographics of the folks who are playing in the NFL and also the folks who are in head coaching positions, the numbers don't seem encouraging right now. Why do you think, I mean, the critics are saying that the rule isn't working. Why do you think that is?
I think just because they're looking at the broad number of coaches. So like you have 32 teams in the NFL and only four of them are people of color. So you can look at that and say that this rule is not working. I would argue that the rule actually is working, that people who would have never received an interview are actually getting that. And maybe if they don't get the position that they're interviewing for, maybe down the road that they will. I don't necessarily agree with that stance, but it is true that that is what's happening. But you have a problem with, and you ask why is it not working as far as getting more people in there? I think it just goes back to the decision makers, and maybe it's, they have these preconceived notions about African Americans or people of color and their ability to lead people. But I think it goes back to these decision makers maybe not being racist, but there's a hint of racism there in that they don't trust or don't believe in African Americans or people of color and their ability to take a team and take them to the Super Bowl or the playoffs.
So we just heard ESPN Smith saying, get rid of the rule. I feel like that's an easy way out. Should it be? I mean, am I wrong about that? If you got rid of the rule, would that actually encourage more hiring?
I don't think so. It'd probably do the exact opposite. Because like I said, in 2003, 40 years after the March on Washington, the NFL teams had to be forced to just interview candidates, not necessarily hire them, but to interview them. And like you said, the numbers show that, you know, one, more of them are being interviewed just by virtue of the rule, and more of them are being hired than they were before. And if you get rid of that interview, you get rid of the sham interviews that we sometimes have, the Rooney Rule interviews, where, you know, you have a running backs coach, a black running backs coach, who no one believes will actually be hired, but they're just doing it just to satisfy the rule. But down the road, that person might get hired, right? But at the end of the day, it's a sham interview. But if you didn't have the rule in place, period, then that person might have not even got his foot in the door. So I can understand the frustration with the rule, but if you get rid of it, I think we're going backwards rather than forward.
You know, right now there are currently four non-white coaches in the NFL, Mike Tomlin, Anthony Lynn, Brian Flores, and Ron Rivera. Have any of them spoken out about some of the hurdles that they face compared to their white counterparts?
Yeah, so there's been stories, whether on the Undefeated or other websites, where I think they probably soften a little bit just because, you know, you can't really ruffle any feathers in that league of all leagues.
If you're a person of color, you mean?
If you're a person of color, right? And I don't know how many white coaches have spoken out about it. I know Bruce Arians with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers have. But they have spoken in the past about, you know, it's difficult. Sometimes you feel that no matter how hard you work, you're never going to get that position. Or once you get that position, how difficult it is to maintain it. Because, you know, there's an old adage among African Americans that you have to be twice as good to get kind of half as far. And so once they get these positions, it's difficult for them to keep it. Like, there's been countless times where African-American coaches have had 1 year to either make it or not, and then they're fired. And there's been times where white coaches, with Freddie Kitchens this year with the Cleveland Browns, where he was fired after one season, too. But it does seem with African-Americans, there's a shorter leash for them to maintain their job. And African-American coaches have spoken about it, but it's not going to be like how I'm speaking about it now. Like, they're going to say, you know, I waited my turn. I got to a point, but it is difficult for them.
there's something that comes up in these conversations where there becomes a question about whether or not we should just continue to rely on the good faith efforts, quote unquote, of organizations to provide these interviews, or whether there should be more stringent requirements in place. Should there be percentages, numbers? You know, should there be something else that's a little more strict in with written within the Rooney Rule, where organizations have to show that they are in fact hiring?
Yeah. So when Johnny Cochran presented the study to the NFL in 2002, and then a year later the Rooney Rule was implemented, he recommended that there was some type of quota or some type of good faith effort that teams had to put forward to hiring African American or people of color coaches, and if they didn't, they would be docked a draft pick. And we've seen before that's how the NFL has punished teams before, whether it's through what the New England Patriots have been accused of, or the New Orleans Saints, where they docked draft picks or docked pay from the organization or the head coach. So I think if you truly want to get to a point where it's not just sham interviews and these owners actually want to put forth an effort to diversify their head coaching and front offices, maybe you do have to threaten them with draft pick sanctions, because what we've reached at this point 17 years after the fact is that some coaches will get a legitimate interview and some of them will become a head coach. But for a lot of these head coaching vacancies, it's going to be sham interviews and they're just going to bring someone in just to satisfy a rule that they don't truly believe in.
Martenzi Johnson is a sports writer for ESPN's The Undefeated. Martenzi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, everyone, that's it for us today. We want to give a shout out to our production team, Ethan Oberman, Rob Gunther, Jose Olivares, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, Jivika Varma, and Andres O'Hara. Our senior producer is Alexandra Botie. Polly Irungu is our digital editor. Claire McKean and Debbie Daughtry are our board operators. Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer. And David Gable is our executive assistant. Special thanks to Lee Hill as well. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.